This show is brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup and GoTo Assist Express. It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 366. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me suggestions for future show topics or any question. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. Phone number is 240-949-2450. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow, and Facebook. Send me a friend request, facebook.com/MikeTechShow. I have a jam-packed show tonight. Lots to get to. A great voicemail that's going to spur some comments. I have lots of feedback. And then, of course, I have a rant on, just for a minute or two, you got to bear with me, on the new OS X upgrade 10.7, which they have dubbed Lion. I like where someone put in the chat, shoot the lion. Yes, I agree. I want to welcome Carbonite as new sponsor to the podcast. Carbonite Online Backup protects your pictures and your other computer files by automatically backing them up wherever you're online. When you have your inevitable disaster, Carbonite makes it easy to get your backed up files back with just a few clicks. Carbonite has helped restore over 7 billion computer files that otherwise might have been lost forever. With Carbonite, you can access your backed up files privately from any computer or your smartphone or iPad, which is a free app. Unlimited backups for your PC or Mac with anytime, anywhere access is only $59 a year. That's less than $5 a month. Start your free 15-day trial at Carbonite.com. No credit cards required. Use the offer code TPN and you'll get 2 free months if you decide to buy. That's Carbonite.com and the offer code for 2 free months is TPN. So yesterday, I was very excited. All the hoopla surrounding the OS X Lion upgrade for the Mac. And now you can upgrade via the online app store. So it was very simple. I clicked on the app store and there was Lion for the first click. I had some money in my Apple store account. So it was perfect. Before you upgrade, you got to make sure that you have all the updates done on your system. You have to be the 64-bit Intel Core 2 Duo processor. Anybody that has processors prior to that on the Mac platform, you're out of luck. So you have to have the OS X version 10.6.8, and then you're able to apply the update. So I go to my iMac, and I want to experience the upgrade, and I just dive right in, and it takes a long time to download. It's about 4 gig, and it downloads to the local hard drive, and that took about 20 minutes, and when it was all done, it prompted me to continue, and it creates a little partition that it will reboot into, and then it starts the install process. Install process was like 35 minutes. When it was done, I was presented with a new login screen, and when I logged in, the first thing I noticed was I kept getting VNC error. It just kept coming up because I have VNC Enterprise for the Mac. So on my local area network, I can remote control my Mac. It's what I use on the network. It will not stop. There's a problem with the app, and you got to press OK, and it just kept doing it. To the point where I went to VNC Enterprise and I clicked uninstall. Okay, I can live without VNC. They probably have an upgrade that I didn't apply. So I wanted to test something. I have my consulting laptop, which is a MacBook Pro, and I decide if I use the same account, since the upgrade costs $30, shouldn't I be allowed to perform the upgrade on my system, on my MacBook, for the same price, you know, just that $130? And that's exactly what happened. I went to the App Store and clicked the option, apps that I have purchased. And since I have purchased Lion, I'm now logged on the same Apple iTunes account. It allowed me to install. So this was what I was really testing for everyone, which is you can have multiple instances of downloading on one account. And it works flawlessly. And the upgrade happened and with the same process. So now I go back. I'm doing some tests where I know we're going to broadcast Tech Vets last night. I bring up Soundbite, which is my cart player that I rely on for my show. I absolutely, totally depend on this program for supplying the audio that you hear. Voicemail messages, the drop-ins, the intro, outro, all the music I play in the post show. And every time I ran and launched, the app crashes and it gives me the crash message and it says you can restart or hit OK. I tried everything. I even went online and there was an upgrade to, but it was an older upgrade to Soundbite. And this is from Black Cat Systems. And I downloaded that, same problem. Now I'm mad that I didn't go through checking. I do a little reading and I find a link that I'm going to put in the show notes that lists thousands of applications that are known to not work with OS X Lion. So you got to be kidding me. I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot of applications that are broke. There's another program called App Flash, I believe. It's to check on all my applications and do upgrades. That crashed. Now I'm really upset because every app I go to touch closes and crashes. And as you're scrolling with, I have the new, I got it a couple years ago, but the Bluetooth, I guess the smart mouse, it's almost like a trackpad and mouse. I want to know who invented this for this upgrade. Why would they make, when you scroll your fingers and you move down, that you scroll up? And when you move your fingers up, it scrolls down. They say this is to make it easier for you. I say, you got to be kidding me. You mean now I gotta adjust everything that up is down and down is up? What am I, in outer space flying something? You got to be kidding me. I look online and I see it's just a checkbox that you have to go into system preferences. You go to your trackpad or you go to your mouse and there's a little checkbox. You can uncheck what they call natural scrolling. Well, guess what? It's unnatural scrolling. This is not how human beings operate. I went looking to see if I could right click and is there any way that I could launch an application in compatibility mode? Because, you know, this is something from the Windows side that we're used to, that as we upgrade to Windows 7 or, you know, we had Vista, you can still run Windows applications in a compatibility mode that is compliant with XP. This is how I've gotten older apps to work for clients. It's very, very nice. Why can't Apple do that? Why can't we have that in Apple? Or maybe it's something I'm missing. Is there a way to run my legacy applications in some kind of a compatibility mode? Because I went looking, maybe I didn't spend enough time. I put a call out to all my Mac listeners, if there are any, probably only a handful, but let me know, is there a way that I have a fighting chance of running these applications? Because I am just inches away from pulling out my Snow Leopard DVD and just blowing everything away and going back to Snow Leopard 10.6 and then reinstalling my applications. I have all my data because I use Time Machine, so all my data is backed up. I'm not worried. I'm not happy here. I am not a happy camper, and I don't like this upgrade. And because of the things that I'm describing, be careful. Don't jump in. Just because Apple has come out with it doesn't mean it's good and it's great and it's got to taste good and we got to like it. Well, I'm stating here I don't like it. I give it a double thumbs down and say do not upgrade to Lion until you verified all of your applications and make sure that they work. Now, remember, mileage is going to vary. You may not have any apps that are impacted. Great. That's nice. Good for you. I'm glad. But you got to be careful here. If you have some core critical apps that I depend on, well, it's impacting my podcast. So I'm not happy with that upgrade, and I most likely will be taking back my iMac to an older version of OS X. Now, on to my MacBook Pro. I'm spending way too much time on this. Don't worry. The show's going to be long, and I'm going to make it up to you. On my MacBook Pro, my main thing was VMware Fusion better work, because that's where my livelihood for consulting is, where I run XP, Windows 7, and Ubuntu Linux, so I can walk into any consulting situation and I am ready. Well, that worked, and at least VMware Fusion worked. Office for the Mac 2011 worked. I tried all of them. Firefox worked, but there are plugin problems, so you got to be careful. Certain plugins will not work with OS X Lion, so just a warning there. Safari seemed to work better. It's an Apple core app. I wasn't worried so much about the Apple apps as I am about these other apps that seem to break, and I'm contacting Black Cat Systems. Hopefully, they'll have some kind of an upgrade. I will say this, by the following podcast, what I may do, the iMac that sits beside me may be my Windows laptop, because the cart player on Windows works, and that's where I may be doing my audio, because I want that coming from a different machine, because I have enough going on with the current machine that's in front of me that's doing all the recording, it's doing all the video, and oh, by the way, anybody who's watching this live, the Flash Media Encoder that I was using for the great audio, it decided not to work properly tonight. So I had to go back to the old standard broadcasting. So I'm just running into all sorts of technical problems here. You know what? Let's get to a voicemail.
Hey, Mike, it's your main man, Byron Brown, coming to you live from the BBTAS studios in Pittsburgh. I had a blast when you came out here for the Pittsburgh meetup, and I hope that we can do it again. In any case, I wanted to ask you a question about email clients. I know you're big on email clients. So here's the question. Whenever it comes to email clients, what are the top features that somebody should look into when choosing an email client? And is there a particular email client you would suggest for a beginner, somebody that's maybe in the mid-ground, and somebody that is very tech-savvy? Look forward to hearing your answer. You have a good one, Mike. May God bless. Bye.
That's a great question, Byer. I'm going to give you an answer for what I think for the novice, for the beginner, and then what I use, what I recommend for an advanced email user, and then I have a middle-of-the-road average user. So let's start with the beginner. Why even introduce a client? Put them on webmail, which is Gmail. It's free. It's easy to use. Just have your client use Gmail. I'll tell you, my tech support went down when I moved my wife onto literally a MacBook running Firefox with Gmail. It doesn't get any better. Doesn't get any easier than that, and had no troubles. So keep it simple. Let's not introduce a client that there's all kinds of things that can break. Have them live online, provided they have a half-decent internet connection. Now, if they have a very slow connection, then you want to use a client that's simple to use, and now it depends on what operating system they have. Hopefully, they're running Windows 7, and you would use Windows Live Mail. That's great. That is what replaced Outlook Express. I don't use it, but I know people that do. I have a lot of listeners I know that use it. I would recommend, as we start to move up from webmail, now you got your Windows Live Mail. But I want to address something. What is your user going to be doing when it comes to contacts And what are they doing with their calendar? Now, certainly contacts and calendar can be handled very nicely with Gmail. What smartphone are they using? And you want to make sure that you can sync properly to that. So you can't just recommend a mail client without finding out a few things. What's their phone? And you want to make sure you have your process down for how they're going to sync their calendar, how they're going to sync their contacts. You also want to make sure, what do they do for their work? What about work-based mail, and do they want to get that at home, and do they want to get that on their smartphone, and what's the platform at work? You have to do a little investigation here, and I think this is going to vary depending on the answers to these questions. What email platform are they using at work? How much calendaring and contacts are they going to be working with? And then what kind of a smartphone? Now, if they don't have to worry about work and they don't have to worry about syncing to a smartphone, Gmail straight up, no problem. Now, for me, for years and years and years, I have been an Outlook hater because Outlook, prior to Outlook 2010, to me was a pig, and it just sucked up all of your CPU and resources. I never had a pleasant experience with Outlook 2000, Outlook 2002, Outlook 2003, Outlook 2007. I've used them all. I've migrated right along with Microsoft. Then I took a year off of Outlook, and I dedicated to only use Thunderbird. And I was very happy with that. Now, you got Thunderbird, which is a great open source free email client that you can have all kinds of add-ins. As a matter of fact, I even took my Thunderbird and there was an add-in that made it look and feel like Outlook, but without all the performance problems. Now, I had to migrate back to Outlook due to some things I was doing with work and communicating to work, and I needed an Outlook client at home, and that was very important, and it forced me back to Outlook. And I suffered through Outlook 2007 until Outlook 2010 came out with Office 2010, and hallelujah, it is a phenomenal program. I give it a thumbs up. Performance is excellent. I'm running the 64-bit version, and I couldn't be happier. That costs money, though, Outlook and Office. So now it depends on what is the budget for the user. And if the user has a budget that is, they already own Office Suite, they may already have Outlook. That would be a consideration to want to use that. Thunderbird is free, and if they have no commitments to no prejudices going into that. And Thunderbird, you want to download that. Have your user use Thunderbird, and that supports POP and IMAP. I have clients that use Thunderbird and love it. And like I said, I used it for a while. Great program. They're the core apps for email that I run into. But now, because I do support Macs and I have Macintosh, you have the older version of Office that came with an Outlook-compatible email client by Microsoft, and they called it Entourage. So I did have some experience with Entourage. I didn't care for that too much. But if you had a Mac and you were talking to an Exchange server, that was the answer. The next one is Mac Mail. Again, I wasn't very impressed with it, so I never really jumped into Mac Mail. So I have always been on the Windows side for email. But now, Office 2011 for the Mac comes with a full-fledged version of Outlook. I actually moved a client who is a new client who's an attorney who wanted to go from Windows to the Mac and wanted to make sure that her email from Outlook to Outlook would work. And it does. As a matter of fact, you can import a Windows PST file directly into Outlook 2011 for the Mac. So remember that. It has great import capability, and I was able to completely move them over. buyer. I took a long way to get to the answer, but I think there's a lot of tiers and layers to answering your question. Personally, I love Outlook 2010 for Windows. I use it all the time, but I strongly recommend using Gmail, and they've made great improvements over the years that Gmail has been out, and there's nothing wrong with having a great webmail client like Gmail. You can do everything that you want, and that would be my first recommendation without having any other information. And then based on what their needs are for syncing to this, to their smartphone, and again, what about their work mail? Can they attach? What are they allowed to use to connect to work? And I think when you start answering those questions, it will direct you into a very specific client. Great question, buyer. Thank you. I want to take a moment and thank Citrix for sponsoring the show. There are two things IT professionals and their clients have in common. They want the job done right, and they want it done fast. That's why I highly recommend GoToAssist Express by Citrix to anyone in IT. It puts clients at ease with its simple and secure remote support and puts you in a position to do what you do best: access, diagnose, and resolve. Try GoToAssist Express free for 30 days. Visit GoToAssist.com/podcast to see how you can deliver live tech support to anyone, anywhere with GoToAssist Express. This email is from Jason, and he says, using OpenDNS as my DNS is breaking local area network. It's breaking up the local area network for remote desktop, network name resolution, and Windows 7 home groups. Mike, I do not recommend the use of OpenDNS anymore because typo correction and CN wildcard options breaks my local area network, remote desktop, and network name resolution and Windows 7 home groups. It personally took hours and hours of research to figure this out, and once I removed OpenDNS, everything on my local network, remote desktop, network name resolution, and Windows 7 home groups started working. OpenDNS might cause your clients printing or networking issues. Here is why. Local networks are typically resolved through a process called NetBIOS. However, DNS takes precedence over NetBIOS. And due to OpenDNS's additional product services such as typo correction, your computer always gets a response from DNS, so it never tries NetBIOS. You can try shutting off typo correction and CN wildcard options. If that doesn't work, there is a registry hack that will make your computer check NetBIOS before DNS. Of course, I can't find a link to this article. And that's interesting feedback that I like to share with everyone on anything that I talk about. There was so much positive about OpenDNS and all the good. It's interesting to share some of the considerations for problems. So here's what I recommend. If you are having any of those issues within your local network, that is the first place to go try to put change back from OpenDNS and put your ISP's DNS in there. Jason, where I think it would work properly is if you're doing DNS in an Active Directory environment locally. So my question to you, Jason, is do you have DNS hosted that's Active Directory integrated on this network? I'm just curious as to that answer. This is something to be aware of. All right, consulting question from Kate. Hi, Mike. Here's a question you could use for the Mike Tech Show podcast if ever you need another email. I'd be interested both in your opinion and that of your listeners. How do you handle it when a customer insists that you put known bad stuff on his computer? I have a computer who is a DJ at parties and so on. He called me because he was having a problem getting Aries Ultra peer-to-peer to work on his new computer. Since he is also using Trend Micro, I think I know why, but I can't confirm that the problem is Trend Micro doing its job until I get out there and have a look at his PC. The domain for his software is on every malware list I know of. Woot, which is Web of Trust, gives it a poor reputation, and from what I can tell, even McAfee Site Advisor doesn't like it. I told my customer that this is bad stuff. I told him why, but he says it's where he gets most of his music he needs for his parties and wants to go ahead with it anyway. I'm not going to debate whether it's legal or ethical to get music that way. The laws are different here in Canada, by the way. What I would like to know is how you and other computer consultants would handle this. Would you go ahead and try to fix the problem? Would you suggest an alternative? And if so, what? I'm thinking uTorrent. Or would you walk away? Thanks, Mike. All right. Great ethical question. I will fix whatever problem my client presents me with. I guess there's a line. And my line's not music or movies. Or if there is clearly something that is a really objectionable, I want to be careful the terms I'm using, but let's say a certain pornography that is just illegal or something like that, that I would draw the line and I would not help him. For just something that is for downloading music or doing something like that, I'd probably help him with the problem. Is there alternatives? Yeah, yes, actually, news groups are the alternative. And I highly recommend Giga News. And then there's a great client for searching that. And it's called Newsbin for Giga News. You could use that, but again, you run the same risk. So you better have a good antivirus program, good malware program running, because even going to news groups, there's the possibility of downloading infected software. And you got to have a little education and you got to be careful. If it's supposed to be an MP3 you're downloading and it's an EXE, clearly it's not a music file. Don't click on it. So a lot of common sense has to be put here. But the reason I wouldn't just walk away is I have a client that is addicted to pornography and gets infected all the time. And he keeps paying me to clean it. You know what? He's going to keep paying me. As frustrating as it is for me, I'll keep cleaning it. You know? And I'll keep doing that. So what do you do? You know? So I'm actually in that situation. And he's doing nothing illegal. So at least that client is doing nothing illegal. And I have to help him all the time with all kinds of problems. And 99.99% of the time, the problems go back to, well, if you don't practice safe surfing habits and safe computing, you're going to be infected. And if you're infected, this is Mike's hourly rate, and I charge him accordingly and do the work. I'll never walk away, but I guess my line, and I guess every consultant out there has a line that you don't cross. And where is that line? And I guess it's as to what are they doing. And I know I have mine. And if I ever hit that, then I walk away. If they're doing something that is just so illegal, so offensive that I just, that's it. I will walk away and possibly report them. So that's another area. You know, do you report people, you know, that you run into? There are certain things that I would. Anyway, I hope that answers your question. And definitely let me know, what would you do? You're in Kate's situation here. Give us some feedback so I can share this on a future show. This is a follow-up question from Pat that I helped. Pat had a quick Ustream question, and he says, I heard your comments on the show. Thanks for your answer. One quick question, please. We will make a video of seminars and want to rebroadcast this. It will not be live video. You mentioned that there were other options besides Webcam Max. Please share what else I can use. This is probably a one-time use, but we may do this again next year. Well, try ManyCam, and I think there's a free version. I know there's a trial version of Webcam Max, but I think they put an ad or something, you know, saying Webcam Max, I think, on the recording. So that's something that you might have to consider with any of the free products. You may not get that crystal clear, clean video because there's going to be some kind of an imprint of the manufacturer because it's free and that's what they're doing. But try ManyCam and see if that's it. I don't know a great competitor that does everything that Webcam Max does because that's why I bought Webcam Max. So if anybody else has some suggestions there for alternatives to Webcam Max, let me know. This is from Matt from Long Island. Mike, I wanted to bring this utility to your attention. It's not freeware, but I at least thought it was worth the money. It is a file recovery utility called Recover My Files. You can go to www.recovermyfiles.com to check it out. Helped me recover a customer's files on a bad hard drive, and I thought it was very simple to use. Very good. Thank you for that recommendation, and I will put that in the show notes. This is from Ben. It's about Show 365, the Vinix alternative. Hi, Mike. I like the show. Although I'm not an IT pro, I learn from it. I realize that I need to be careful about using anything I hear from you that is highly technical on my own system. I don't want to brick my system. You know, he makes a great point. I talk about a lot of utilities, and some of the utilities can be dangerous. You have to be careful. So I'm even trying to screen that myself, and will bring up those points when I'm talking about a certain utility. I'll try to bring up the dangers involved in that. And, you know, I'm mentioning this only if you have a certain problem. And if you don't have that problem, leave the utility alone. He continues, I'm blind and use a free program called NVDA. It's an open source Windows screen reader. It works great with Firefox, IE, Thunderbird, and lots of other programs. I was at one time considering Linux because of better accessibility. Had Vinix been around a few years ago, I'd have switched. NVDA has kept me a Windows user. And the website is www.nvda-project.org. Keep up the good work. Ben, thank you very, very much for that email. This is from Mark. Your show is a godsend, and I hope to one day hear episode 1000. That's awesome. Thank you. Based on your experience with management of enterprise IT and support for SMBs, I have two items I would like to have your input on. Please forgive me if these items seem stupid, trivial, or obvious, but they are items that I have been wondering about, and I would like to hear your practical advice. When attending to a domain user's computer that is experiencing an issue related to strictly their profile on the computer, example, Internet Explorer or Flash issue, do you ask them for their current password to log in as them? I do. I absolutely do. I have typically reset their password in Active Directory users and computers and then attended to the issue. Upon completion, I then typically open a remote session to a domain controller and open Active Directory users and computers and offer the password reset capability for them to reset their password to what it was. I have never asked for user passwords because I always felt that most users try to use some kind of sequential password scheme when password aging is enforced. I work for a small business, and the current domain policy I have in force is 60 days expiration. Can you provide any best practices for use for this action while attending to desktop support and user passwords? What a tremendous question. And I deal with this on a daily basis. I've just come to the realization that it's so much easier for me to have their password. And then I make sure that they understand how they can go reset their password. I ignore their password naming scheme because all the systems that I work on, they have to change their password X amount of days. So it's immaterial, and I don't even give that a consideration. They can elect to reset it or not, and I make sure they understand how to reset the password. Now, what if I need to get into a system? I need to be logged on as that user, and I do not have their password, but I am acting on or have permission from senior management, the president, the owner, someone in power, HR. I will reset their password. Then I will log in as them, do whatever has to be done, log off. I will then tell them what the password is reset to. Now, how do you do that? Simple. You don't want to write down the password. I leave a sticky note on their monitor that says, check your voicemail for new password. And then I leave a voicemail message with the new password. So when they come back to their desk, they have, remember, a password to get into their voicemail. They can hear their voicemail by just reading that note. That's what I've done for large companies where I've had to work as the user because you have to be in their profile. And that happens a lot. That's my way of dealing with it. Also, almost every one of my clients, I have an NDA agreement that they asked me to sign because I'm dealing with very sensitive information, whether it's for their client or the company. I have a tremendous amount of financial advisors and attorneys that are my clients. And so I have NDA agreements with almost every one of my clients. And that protects them that I'm not going to do anything when I learn a password or have a password or have access to any information. I'm not going to share that. I'm not going to take that to another company or do anything with it or tell anything about it because I am liable. As long as you have those kind of agreements in place, then you can, I think, log in as that user. And that's my take. And this is just part one of the question. Let's get to the other part. Our company is currently beginning a migration from XP Pro to Windows 7 Pro. 75% of the company is notebook-based. Some do extensive travel. Many work more than a typical work week in the past with XP, so as not to prohibit users when they may be remote and perhaps need to install an application that requires admin level, I established their accounts as having administrative privileges on the notebooks. In the last 6 months, I have seen an increase in malware and have since, when attending to any issue, changed their privileges to standard user in the power users group. I realize the best practice is considered to be provide the least privilege level. I intend to deliver all Windows 7 machines as standard user. However, I know that I will be encountering the user with Windows 7 that needs to install an application that will require admin level privileges when off site. Absolutely. How would you handle that? Would you remote to their computer and then install the app using RunAs, or would you temporarily change their account type to administrator and then reduce their privilege level at a later date? I don't want to disclose the local administrator password for their use. Although I am employed by a small business, my goal would be to have the IT org, me, function as an enterprise IT organization would without being unnecessarily restrictive. So any input on the above would be appreciated. Thanks, Mark. All right, there's a couple ways to skin this. The one way, in a domain environment, even if they're remote, use group policies to push applications based on the group that user's in. If they need an application to install, It will do this without you having to mess with the privileges. That's what you can do for deploying applications. So I recommend digging very deep into group policies. I think you're going to find your answer there in being able to have software delivered. In a very large organization, you can use programs like Alteris, things like that, that have sort of that run as admin capability built into the package as it is pushed down to the client. That's a couple ways. If there's only a couple users, you don't want to give them the password, but here's what you do. You make sure that the local admin password of the desktop is different than your domain admin password. So let it be a password that you could occasionally share, and then you could always have that changed. But never, ever, ever give up the domain admin password. I would probably make the user a local administrator. I would add them to that group temporarily on the machine and then let them be able to do whatever install they need and then pull them out of the local admin group of the computer. That's what I would do. But if you're in a larger organization, I really think you should spend time with group policy and automated ways of delivering applications. This is from Brian. I was listening to show 363 and was glad to hear about your success with printing through terminal services. I have a client with a satellite office with 6 employees for whom I built a virtual machine server that runs several Windows XP VMs. This allows them to remote in and access the MIS system at the main site. The solution is pretty slick, if I say so myself, using a headless Ubuntu server that runs 6 Windows XP Pro virtual machines in VirtualBox using VBox headless mode. I love it. This server replaced 6 standalone computers running 24/7 in a server room at the main site. It will start paying for itself by the end of the year in electric bill savings, and the end users report that the virtual machines are much faster than the standalone boxes. Cheaper, faster, and better for the environment. Gotta love that. Anyway, I have always struggled with printing through remote desktop and was interested to hear your solution. I wanted to clarify something though. It has been my experience that when printing to the local PC using remote desktop, the printer at the local side must be a non-host based printer in order to work with remote desktop. This has prevented me from using less expensive host based printers and involves the purchase of more expensive printers. Is this what you found as well? Actually, I haven't ran into it enough in the last 2 years, except for this one absolute problem, you know, that I ran into with this one organization. I do know this. We had a policy in the large organization that I was the network manager. We had a policy that you could not expect to print remotely without an IT approved model of the printer, and we controlled the version of the driver that you were using. Very tight controls can reduce your total cost of ownership, obviously, in a large organization. Thanks again for the show. You are always appreciated, and I'd like to give another plug for your Amazon link. If everyone asks their friends and family to use the link when they make purchases, it's a simple way to try to repay you for all the work you put into the show. Just set them up with a bookmark in their browser to make it even easier for them, as I have done. Thanks again, Brian. That's awesome. Thank you very, very much. And I can't think of a better email to close than with that. I have some independent music for tonight. And the group is Retrograde. The song Complicated, I played this a long time ago, one of my garage band finds way back, and dug it up, dusted it off, and it's here for your listening pleasure right now, and I'll be back to wrap up. That is Retrograde and the song Complicated. And I'll find a link to their website and make sure it's in the show notes. That's it for tonight's show. Please remember to use my Amazon link. And that got lowered now on the left-hand side of the website. But scroll down. There's a big link. It's also in every post for the show notes. Click on that. And please continue to use that. And I so appreciate all of your support and help. Thank you so, so much. Stay cool because it's really hot where I'm at. And I'm sure where you are too. I hope you enjoyed the show. And thank you. And I will be back same time, same channel next week. Bye-bye, everybody.